Remember, John Kerry recently said that if these negotiations didn't go well, then we'd have a plan B for Syria and that we wouldn't be able to see Syria whole anymore.
You're listening to the Corbett Report.
Hello, friends. James Corbett here at CorbettReport.com in a conversation that is being recorded on the 31st of March, 2016. And today we're talking to Brandon Turbeville of BrandonTurbeville.com. He's a staff writer at Activist Post and the author of 7 books, including The Road to Damascus, The Anglo-American Assault on Syria, Dispatches from a Dissident, Volume 1 and 2, and 36 Reasons Hillary Clinton Should Never Be President, which is available for free download. I hope people will take a look at that. I think that's a subject that we'll probably talk about in a future conversation, but for the moment, we're going to be talking about another article that he wrote recently that was posted up to BrandonTurbeville.com. The link will be in the show notes as always. Kurdish Federalization, Reminiscent of Kerry's Plan B, Brzezinski, NATO's Plan A. An interesting and very, very detailed article on a subject that I think is very important and is not receiving a lot of attention in the media or the alt media. So good to have you on, Brandon. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, James.
Let's dive right into this. And with a subject like this, it can be a confusing morass of acronyms, basically. There's the PYD and the YPG and the PKK and whatever else there is floating around in this stew. Can you break down who are the main groups involved here? What Kurdish groups are we talking about? Where are they located? And what is this federalization plan that's being proposed?
Okay, well, there's essentially three main groups of Kurdish players that people need to understand. There are Kurds in Iran, and these guys are not necessarily an integral part of what we're talking about here. But for our purposes, there's three main groups of Kurds that play a role. The first, of course, is the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers Party, and that is located in Turkey. Then there's the PYD, which is the Democratic Union Party, which is the Syrian Kurds, and there's also the YPG in Syria. That's the People's Protection Units. All these names and acronyms don't necessarily jive with one another in English when they're transliterated, but PYD and YPG are in Turkey. In Syria, and the PKK is in Turkey. And then, of course, we have the Peshmerga in Iraq. And these groups of Kurds are what often people refer to as the Barzani Kurds, the Barzani Network, right? These are the Iraqi Kurds. And all of them work together, but they all work separately, too. So this is always kind of confusing to people. Some of them are considered terrorist groups. Some of them are not considered terrorist groups. The United States supports some of them some of the time and then doesn't support them some of the time. And the United States actually helps control other groups of them. So this is all somewhat confusing to a lot of people. The PKK in Turkey, of course, are considered a terrorist group by Erdogan's government because they are consistently trying to break off from Turkey. In Syria, it's a little bit different. The PYD, which is the political wing of the YPG, which is the military wing the YPG is, they have been fighting ISIS. They have been fighting the Syrian government as well. And this is should be clear enough that they're interested in one thing and one thing only, which is a Kurdish state in northern Syria. The Barzani Kurds in Iraq are notoriously controlled by U.S. intelligence and by Israeli intelligence. So they that's why you see the ability of stolen Syrian oil to be able to go up through Iraq and into Turkey through these Kurdish areas, because the Barzani Kurds are essentially allowing them to do that because they're being directed to do that by Israeli and American intelligence. Now, what we saw recently was the declaration of autonomy or semi-autonomy from the Syrian state by the PYD in Syria. They essentially declared, they made a declaration of federalization, not outright independence, but federalization. And when you look at those documents, what you see is that they clearly want to be separate from the Syrian government, and they've stated that they do not want to essentially declare full-out independence and be a separate country, that they want to be part of Syria. But when you look at their document, you can see that what they consider being part of Syria is not really being fully part of Syria, because the idea is that it's, they call it federalization, but I think confederalization would be an even a slightly better term, that there would be a number of different parts of Syria, such as what they've done in Iraq. But the Kurds in Syria are even arguing for some even looser version of this. So part of the Syrian government, this current Syrian government, would essentially act only as a conduit for negotiations between two, three, four, five different states that are essentially Syrian, but not Syrian as we would think about it. The Kurdish document that was released has the areas that they've declared go essentially from the northwestern tip of Syria all the way to the northeastern tip of Syria, and then down some length. They mention in that document that they hope that their formula for independence or autonomy would be a model for other ethnic groups in Syria. This is problematic for a couple of reasons, and one of them is because the Kurds in Syria are actually a minority in the northern part of Syria. They're not the only ethnic group in northern Syria. It's very mixed in these areas, and a lot of the people who are there are kind of concerned about the fact that this area is going to be given to Kurdish forces. Now, Kurdish forces in northern Syria have acted gallantly against ISIS on a number of occasions. Remember, there was the battle around Kobani, which is the Kurdish word for Ain al-Arab in northern Syria. That was a gallant battle. But the Kurdish forces have also engaged in war crimes against Christians, and they've engaged in war crimes against other ethnicities as well, attempting to push them out so they can declare that they are essentially the majority and that this is Kurdish land. So nobody should look at these guys as perfect. Nobody should look at them as anything to really to admire in that sense. And once you look at their documents, the idea of what they consider their what they call Rojava, what they consider their Kurdish state to be based on, is somewhat extreme communism, cultural Marxism, this bizarre brand of feminism that is actually would most likely keep women from making choices. We don't need to really go into that, but it's an extremely bizarre version of cultural Marxism and Marxist feminism and that sort of thing. It's something that people should take a look at, especially in that declaration. But back to my original point was that they state in that declaration that they want to see their federalization plan as a model for other ethnic groups. This would include the Sunnis, the Druze, the Assyrians, and a number of other ethnic groups there. Now, that's problematic because of the ethnic and religious divisions that it's going to provide to a country that has been so far united against terrorism. But it's also reminiscent of plans that we've seen from other people. Remember, John Kerry recently said that if these negotiations didn't go well, then we'd have a plan B for Syria and that we wouldn't be able to see Syria whole anymore. And we've also seen this plan from other people, right? The idea that there would be separate areas of Syria broken off. For instance, Robin Wright, who is of the U.S. Institute for Peace that used to be YNAP, right, neocon organization, and she wrote an article arguing some time ago that Syria should be federalized, that it should be broken up into these different ethnic groups and different religious groups. And she argued that there should be a country, a separate state for Alawites, for Druze, for Sunnis, for Kurds, and for Shiites to some degree. And in her argument, the Alawite state would go up from Damascus through Homs, Hama, Latakia, and those areas. The Druze area would be the southern tip of Syria, Dara, places like that. And the Sunni areas would be in the rural eastern part of Syria and on into western Iraq. And but there have been some arguments about whether or not they should even be in Western Iraq. And then, of course, the Kurdish version in northern Syria. So that is her argument. And what you would see if that happened would be a Sunni state in rural Syria, aside from the fact that it would cripple a united government, that it would cripple a united people, it would essentially act as a barrier for Iran to ship weapons and equipment and all kinds of support to the Syrian military and to Hezbollah, and even the minor support that is supplied to Hamas. It would essentially act as a buffer, as an obstacle to Iran from getting that equipment into Hezbollah. Now, it could be done through other means, but that's going to put a serious obstacle in the way of that. And, of course, that is in line directly with the U.S.-NATO-Israeli plan that we've seen. And we've seen talk of this federalization before, right? We've had Michael O'Hanlon writing in Reuters and the Brookings Institution a number of articles where he writes this plan exactly to break up Syria and almost these same designations that Robin Wright mentions and that the Kurds mention. And we can go back even further to Zbigniew Brzezinski's books like The Grand Chessboard, where you see this exact same type of argument being made, right? The breaking up of target countries into what he calls micro states and mini states. This is this idea of creating petty, impotent, quabbling little states that can never fully stand up to an invading force, imperialist force like the United States, like NATO, nor could they stand up to a major corporation or a major bank. They're impotent. And they're constantly quabbling with their neighbors over ethnic differences, religious differences, and so forth. So that's what I mean when I say that the Kurds' plan for federalization is just like Kerry's plan B, which is itself Brzezinski's plan A and NATO's plan A all along.
Right. It seems like this is just another iteration of let's support this ethnic faction when and if it's convenient to do so to try to destabilize, you know, what the real target here is, which seems to be to, as you say, to break that Shia Crescent and to break the land bridge over to Lebanon to further destabilize Iran, really. And this is something I've been saying since the beginning of Syria, that ultimately this is targeting Iran one way or another. So it looks like they're getting there. But let me get this straight. So this declaration that's come out from these Kurdish factions is not officially recognized by anyone. In fact, they don't even officially have a table at the Geneva Peace Conference. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's actually something that Russia opposed. They argued that the Kurds should be included in the negotiations. And some have argued that the Kurdish declaration is a reaction to not being included in the negotiations. I don't think that that's personally true, simply because they declared autonomy in 2014. So this has been a plan all along. So they don't have a voice at the negotiations, and they're not recognized by any of the parties that are taking part. So that's correct.
It's interesting. I would assume that Russia would not be on board with this federalization plan, if only because, as you say, if it does produce that domino effect and you carve out that Alawite area into Latakia, which of course is the Russian base there, one would assume that would not work in Russia's favor. Perhaps I'm wrong on that calculation. Is Russia behind this idea of breaking Syria up?
They're not, at least publicly. A lot of the statements that have been made have been taken somewhat out of context. And recently we saw Sergey Lavrov state that anybody who said that Russia was supporting the federalization of Syria were outbids, or basically people who were just attempting to twist his words. That's what they've said publicly, and it doesn't seem to bear out that they are actually supporting federalization. Their line is that if the Syrian people want federalization, they should have federalization. If they want a united government, they should have a united government. Even publicly, they are not stating that Assad should stay in power. The public line is that if the Syrian people want Assad, they can have Assad. So it seems that, you know, with Lavrov's confirmation yesterday that Russia is not publicly endorsing or condemning anything, the public line is that they're waiting to see what the Syrian people say.
So obviously, the group that would be most viciously and violently opposed to this, other than the Syrians, potentially, would, of course, be Turkey. And Erdogan, obviously, does not want to see this happen because they do not want a Kurdish state on their doorstep, potentially empowering the Kurdish factions within Turkey itself. What has Erdogan's reaction been, and how does that play into what's going on in Geneva?
Well, Erdogan has reacted predictably with fiery speeches and brimstone and predictions of all kinds. Now, there have been arguments by some people that Erdogan is not as concerned with this as perhaps you might think, simply because this would provide a justification for some type of military invasion of Syria, and that they could get this Ottoman Empire back by using the justification of a Kurdish state or Kurdish aggression. If it's committed by the PKK, they can link the two together and come in. If you have a broken up, federalized Syria, the resistance to that is going to be almost nothing. But Erdogan himself, I think, is very frightened of the fact that the PKK and the YPG might link up officially and attempt to declare an even bigger Kurdistan that's carved out of Turkey. And then we have an even bigger war than they had with the Civil War many years ago. One of his reactions, this was before the declaration, and it was 4 days before the attacks in Brussels. This is interesting to note that Erdogan came out and said that if you continue to play with fire, you can see attacks happening across Europe in places like Brussels, and he named Brussels specifically. Now, coincidence? Maybe, but he, you know, is very close with ISIS, and ISIS has claimed responsibility for this attack, and this is who the attack is being blamed on. If anybody knew the whereabouts and the plans of ISIS, Erdogan would certainly be on that short list. So you have to wonder whether or not this is a coincidence or whether or not this is simply insider information.
Another obvious player at this table would be Israel. And how does this plan for federalization square up or not square up with Oded Yonon or Clean Break or some of the other foreign policy ideas we've seen in Israel to destabilize Syria specifically in years past?
Well, this is very similar to the Yonon plan. This was, again, a plan that was put forward to break up states in the Middle East for the benefit of Israel, and eventually the spread of Israel. Some of these plans have their ultimate goal was the opening and spreading of the Israeli state. But again, I go back to plans like Brzezinski. Look at who would benefit, right? If Lebanon loses Hezbollah, if Hezbollah is taken out or weakened, who would benefit from that? Of course, that would be Israel, because Hezbollah is one of the most effective fighting forces in the Middle East. Hezbollah is the reason, not the Lebanese military proper, that Israel hasn't been able to take any more territory from Lebanon to begin with. If that support is weakened, if the Shiite crescent is broken and the support to Hezbollah is cut off and Hezbollah is weakened, then that strengthens Israel and probably one of its biggest opposition forces within its close range, Syria being number two. You know, this would greatly benefit the Israeli geopolitical position if these forces were broken, particularly Syria and particularly Hezbollah. Hamas, not so much. Hamas is already controlled largely by Israeli intelligence. It was created by that. So they're more concerned with Hezbollah and Syria. But to your point, the Yonon plan, this is the implementation of it in a sense.
It certainly appears that way, or at least the first domino part of that, as you say, is it could spread out to other parts of the country, which I guess brings up the other player at this table, which would be the Gulf states, obviously Saudi Arabia, Qatar, who have been helping to fund and supply the terrorist insurgency in Syria in the first place. Do you think they would be happy with this as a potential start to the carving out of a Sunni Syria/Iraq autonomous state of some sort? Or do you think that's not what they ultimately have in mind for their endgame?
Well, I think they do have that in mind simply because of financial motive, right? The idea of crippling Iran is extremely lucrative to places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, if for no other reason that it eliminates competition in the oil business. Remember, we saw a lot of disagreement over that when the Qatari pipeline was scheduled to go through Syria, which was nixed by Assad, and in favor of the Iranian pipeline. Now we see we started to see attacks actually that were right along the areas where the pipeline were supposed to go through. And of course, that opens up a much bigger geopolitical situation, because if you allowed that to happen, if you're allowing gas to come through all the way up to Europe with a Russian ally, you're strengthening Russia and you're weakening the NATO allies, which of course are allied with the GCC. And ultimately, the goal here is not just to use Syria as a stepping stone to Iran, but it's to use Syria as a stepping stone to Iran, which itself is a stepping stone to Russia. And that should be frightening to everybody involved, because as I mentioned, Brzezinski earlier, his book, The Grand Chessboard, stated clearly that Russia was a target because they have a plan for federalization of Russia, just similar to the one they have for Syria. So the idea here is that you don't want Russia or a Russian ally to be able to transport oil and gas into Europe and thus be able to hold Europe by the scruff of the neck and have, you know, and have a knife to it the whole time. At any time, for instance, in Europe, Russia could cut off the oil and gas spigots, and it could get very cold very fast. That's something that they want to prevent, because that's one of the few things that Russia has holding over the heads of Europe right now. So the oil interest is another important aspect. And of course, just geopolitically, Saudi Arabia does not want to see a Shiite-led government, or any government that could compete with them in influence in the region.
Well, that certainly speaks to a number of things, including the terrorist insurgency in the Northern Caucasus and how that can play into the long-term plan of destabilizing and federalizing the Russian state. But anyway, so we have this declaration, which at this point, as far as I know, is really just a declaration of federal autonomy by this Kurdish group, but it still has yet to be realized in reality. Where is this idea right now? It's in, I assume, some sort of limbo. Is the next step to wait to see what happens at Geneva, and we'll see what plays out from there, or is there some other process that's taking place here?
Yeah, the next step would be to wait and just see what happens in terms of the political negotiations, because if it's agreed that Syria will stay united, and that is the basis for what we're working on. Bashar Jafari just said any idea to carve up Syria by ethnic groups or draw any artificial boundaries should just be, he said, put that out of your head. That's a direct quote. So after these negotiations are made, the question is going to be, how does the Syrian government respond to that, particularly after ISIS forces are removed from the area, and then we have this coming to a head of how the Syrian government is going to respond to the Kurds. So that's going to be a secondary issue after the opposition, quote-unquote opposition, and terrorist forces are dealt with. So that's something that we're going to have to see, whether or not the Kurds really want to pick a fight with the Syrian government over that. I certainly hope that they don't. But just to mention a point that you brought up earlier about the Chechen terrorism in Russia, it's interesting that in the Kurdish document, they mention Chechens as being native to the Rojava area in Syria. And sorry, they're not. They're not native there at all. That's a falsehood. That's a myth. And they're drawing unity there with a group of people who are essentially fanatics in the same sense of the terrorists that are fighting in Syria. There are plenty of Chechen terrorists fighting in Syria on the part of NATO and Saudi Arabia and the other interested powers. So that is the kind of thing that you can take a look at the document and see that they mention these individuals. They mention Turks as well as being native to the area. And again, the Kurds weren't native to Syria either. That's relatively recent. But people should check that document out for themselves, and we'll just have to wait and see whether or not they're willing to pick a fight with the Syrian government, or if they're willing to just let it pass and argue for any kind of autonomy politically in the parliament.
Yeah, it will be very interesting. And as you say, this does tie into the much bigger picture, including the Chechens and the Xinjiang area and fighters from there being smuggled in via Turkey. I mean, it's there's a bit much bigger picture, and it points to systematic support of these types of terrorist organizations in places that are politically convenient for the forces arrayed against the Iran-Russia-China axis, as it were. So there's a much bigger geopolitical situation here. There's a microcosmic situation in terms of this particular federal autonomous area or whatever it is, and there's a lot of different moving pieces on this chessboard, and probably too much for us to possibly encapsulate in a conversation like this. So I'll direct people once again to the article Kurdish Federalization Reminiscent of Kerry's Plan B, Brzezinski NATO's Plan A. Again, the link will be in the show notes for this conversation, along with a link to BrandonTurbeville.com and to your regular radio broadcast on UCY.TV, Truth on the Tracks. This is your first time on the program. Perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
Sure, thanks. My website is BrandonTurbeville.com, and that's going to have all the articles, all the interviews. This will be up there. All the books are linked there as well. And the radio show is Truth on the Tracks, UCY.TV, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, UCY.TV. And you could just follow my work at BrandonTurbeville.com. All the relevant information is there on the site. Everything that I do is posted up there. It's kind of the home for my work. And thanks again for having me on, James.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your expertise on this issue. I hope we can definitely talk about these types of issues again in the future. Thanks for being on.
Anytime.